Future Hacker. Life. Path. Future.
Apoio Instituto Brasileiro de Ciências e Inovações.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the international edition of Future Hacker. This is Maria Taide, and that's the second episode with Roger Spitz. If you haven't heard the first episode, make sure you do. We talked a lot about innovation, ethics, education, and you know the skills needed for the future of our countries, honestly, all the skills needed to deal with all the uncertainty that we're currently living and how we should be focusing on important discussions regarding ethics and investment in science and technology. So, Roger, welcome back. Thank you so much for being here with us.
My pleasure, Maria. It's so fantastic to be with you and with Future Hacker.
Beyond all this change that we talked about in the leadership profiles and all the education needed, should there not also be a change in how innovative companies are evaluated? You mentioned that traditional strategic playbooks are no longer valid when it comes to future-proofing companies. What would you suggest should be the drivers for evaluation of those companies?
There's a lot going on with those questions, and I like to think about it in three different ways. The first one is the broader theme of stakeholder capitalism. Although it doesn't directly answer the question in terms of valuing companies for innovation and maybe long-term initiatives, I think it's linked, because what happens with shareholder primacy or shareholder capitalism, which you have today, is that you have, of course, a board of directors which is elected by the shareholders, and they're responsible and accountable. You know, effectively that board and the management is accountable to the board and ultimately to the shareholders. And what happens is that the shareholders are focused on quite short-term metrics and performance indicators, whether it's earnings per share growth, whether it's revenue growth, profitability. I think the point number one is, unless the shareholders, there's a change in framework in which shareholders look at companies and the market does, and one moves towards stakeholder capitalism and looking at society as a whole, but also longer term timeframes, I think there won't be a big change personally. And I actually wrote a piece recently on the future of shareholding, which I won't talk about, but which effectively touches upon those topics. So I think the first element is companies are valued in a specific way, especially in the public markets. And that to me is not necessarily conducive to innovation. The second point, and this is, I'm going to introduce a recent exchange, which was set up called the Long-Term Stock Exchange by Eric Rice. They're basically looking at exactly that problem, not necessarily in terms of stakeholder capitalism, but in terms of the long-term time frame required for innovation. And so the Long-Term Stock Exchange is literally a stock exchange which is looking at different metrics so that companies can measure their progress over decades and not financial quarters. And here, it's very interesting because it's really, you know, it's called LTSE, Long-Term Stock Exchange. It's a securities exchange, which is public, a public market. And really, the whole driver to that is exactly to your point, Maria, which is the time frames and what's required for innovation and how is that then valued in companies. And I'll let the people who listen in and who are interested take a closer look at the Long-Term Stock Exchange if they're not familiar with it. But it's a very interesting model, and I hope it's successful, and it's an alternative to more short-termism and where I don't think innovation is valued that well. And the third filter I applied to looking at the valuation is something which I call the anti-fragility index, which doesn't exist, but which I'm spending a lot of time thinking about what an anti-fragility index would look like. And here I'm drawing from Nicholas Taleb's book, Anti-Fragile, which is effectively a fragile system is one which is damaged by disorder, where there's more downside than upside from shocks. We don't have time now through the session to go through everything that entails, but just to give you one or two, you know, brief examples, if you take, for instance, financial theory says that a company should not hold any cash on the balance sheet, and that basically you should optimize the cash and even be leveraged and have debt, right? But that's based on financial theory, which actually that, you know, is just simply not appropriate and not relevant. Because in reality, if you look at the share buybacks that the world has done in 2019, they probably bought back close to $1 trillion or $700-800 billion of their shares. That they use debt for, some of them. And effectively, now they need the cash. They're not allowing the companies to do as much innovation. And they're doing that just to please the shareholders quickly and just simply because they're told that having cash on the balance sheet is not optimized. But in reality, it's a theoretical concept which doesn't work. As we can see in Silicon Valley, if you take the big tech companies, they have hundreds of billions of cash on the balance sheet. They're valued as the most valuable companies in the world. And clearly, they're not following that quote unquote financial theory. And that, for me, is a fragile strategy, what a lot of these companies are doing versus anti-fragile strategy. And I think it would be good to have some kind of an index or benchmark to assess companies in those terms.
I personally haven't heard of the long-term stock exchanges model, so I'm definitely going to research after this interview. And, you know, it's actually good to know, it's great to know that there's this whole movement and it's a hot topic now, not only this shift of the focus on shareholders to the stakeholders. We have now the ESG that is becoming more popular through the investors. Now this long-term stock exchanges model. So somehow we are going to be able, you know, choose the companies that we're investing and at least being a client that are actually creating a positive impact globally. It makes a lot of sense what you said, and it actually gives me a lot of optimism regarding the future. But, you know, now let's change completely the subject. Let's talk a little about artificial intelligence. You are cohabitating with artificial intelligence. What is the value of knowledge, especially when it comes to specializations? And how should humans position ourselves and get prepared for the skills of the future?
That's really an important, like all of the topics we've touched upon, theme, because it comes back ultimately to staying competitive in terms of today's world and especially tomorrow's world. And then it comes back to the same importance of it starts at school with education, right? So there are different themes that we talked about. I think the first one is around simply the concept of specialization. And we talked a little bit earlier about how, or in the previous session, how innovative Israel is. And one of the areas which I find fascinating with Israel is precisely the cross-fertilization between people who have, you know, let's call it a T-shaped profile or even the X-shaped profiles, the neo-generalists, together with deep expertise, but combining that with the broad experience. And that really allows you to see new combinations in a world where patterns are harder to interpret. I feel that one of the reasons, in addition to having complementary views and diverse views and to see new innovative combinations by bringing different perspectives, I actually think it's also to do with the fact that we're moving from an increasingly complicated world to an increasingly complex world. And in a complicated world, there are known unknowns, and therefore there is value in having expert views and specialists, and there is a range of right answers. In the complex world, there are unknown unknowns, and there's not necessarily a right answer. And so if you're focusing too much on deep specialization and knowledge, in a sense, because to a degree you could argue that specialization is related to knowledge, in the complex world, that might be of less benefit. So you really need that cross-fertilization. Then in terms of the skills, when you're thinking about AI, it's really just thinking of where is the value added for us as humans compared to technology. And that brings us to thinking about, you know, what are the 21st century skills? And again, you're going to have, I guess, three pillars here. One is the foundational core skills, which are very important. And I think the educational system does okay with these, which is numeracy, literacy, scientific skills. As we move towards what Stephen Hawking described as the 21st century being the century of complexity, which we just talked about, there we need to think about the skills and competencies so students can approach complex challenges. And that's critical thinking, problem solving, creativity, collaboration. And the qualities in terms of how do you approach a changing environment? Curiosity, initiative, persistence, grit, leadership, adaptability, and those type of skills. And so it's really thinking about the three sets of skills for a more complex world. And the reason this is so important is because children who are entering primary school, they're going to be leaving that school and the schooling system to go to jobs which may not even exist yet. And so unless we change the knowledge-based educational system and understand the relationship with AI and where the strengths of humans are, it's going to be difficult to have an educational system which is basically rewarding students for repeating the right answers to known problems. And so that imagination and curiosity and maybe reading a bit of science fiction, experimenting, iterating, accepting failure, learning from failure, embracing change, all of that long-term thinking and forward-looking thinking is really going to be important. In a way, it's directly linked to the considerations in terms of cohabitating with AI and the specialization topic you referred to initially, Maria.
Yes, great answer. And you know, at the end, we are always going to go back to the education subject, right? But moving forward, staying on the topic of AI, as it currently stands today, it works in a world that is to a degree predictable, as you mentioned, those known unknowns. When it comes to uncertain and unexpected, we still need to rely on human intelligence. So do you see a future that would be more of a combination of processing, machine learning, and the human's ability to deal with an unexpected, than a future in which machines outpace human intelligence? So basically, with everything that is happening today, are we moving towards a cyberpunk future rather than a solarpunk one?
I think the choice is ours. I think the, you know, one of the important things as a futurist is to consider that indeed there are multiple, you know, different possible futures out there, and that we have agency in terms of thinking about the futures we might prefer and trying to achieve those futures or that future. I would start by saying that it's very essential for the world to understand that we have that choice. And that today, what's sure, I think as Sue Siegel mentioned, you know, 2 years ago, the GE executive, the pace of change will never be as slow as it is today. As that accelerates, we are also moving towards more and more complex domains. Within that, you need to understand that you have entire systems, that they're unpredictable, that they're interdependencies, and we need to develop certain agility to understand what emergent behavior you should have, what experimentation and tinkering to fail fast, to allow instructive patterns to emerge, what should you amplify or dampen in terms of your emergent behavior to go through that process of decision-making and managing complex domains, which computers are not necessarily today that good at. The choice for me is one which humanity has, which is the following. On one hand, humans adapt. We understand the challenges of the more complex world and the speed of change. And we understand the need to become more agile and more anticipatory and more anti-fragile. And we can then add value when we're partnering with machines. And here AI is providing insights to augment us and to make more informed decisions. They're helping us uncover, you know, new opportunities, and they're able to simulate and do some pattern recognition at scale, which we can't for unstructured data. But it's a symbiotic, it's a good relationship. The alternative is that the humans fail to adapt to our increasingly complex world. And so here, I think there is a risk as machines continue to learn and maybe become versatile and fluent in decision-making and operating in complex domains, and we could then find ourselves marginalized and take the whole decision-making process out of our hands. I think we have agency today. We may not in 5, 10, or 15 years, but I think today, as you and I speak, Maria, and having this lovely discussion, we do have a choice between the dystopian future, which is effectively AI takes that process of decision-making out of our hands because the world is just too complex for us to operate in, and we then could end up with decentralized autonomous organizations or swarm AI. Effectively, they optimize decisions that are made by algorithms because the world is so complex and we haven't been able to upgrade ourselves. or hopefully, as you alluded to, we have a nice symbiotic relationship where both humans and AI bring something to the equation. But I would watch out, and my warning is AI is learning fast, and that train has, you know, left the station. And therefore, we really need to focus on, and again, to your point, it comes back to education. What do we need to do to make sure that we end up with that symbiotic relationship with algorithms, machines, technology, call it what you will?
Yes. Oh my God. There's so much to dig into that. But you know, we're almost coming to an end. Let's still talk about the trends and our future. You did mention in one of your lectures that I saw, moving from convergence to fusion, as in merging biological, physical, and digital, merging human intelligence with cognitive computing. So could you please deeper into that?
It's what I define the move from convergence, which I think we're already in that convergence area, where convergence, you have different technologies that converge. AI, 5G, Internet of Things, immersive reality, sensors, all of these are progressing, but they're progressing in a way that are convergent. And that's what's creating digital synergies, and it's the smart machines, and it's, you know, cyber physical, and it's cognitive computing, and it's cloud, and the things we talked about around, you know, the evolution of technology and that. I think the fusion term is a term which one uses when one is actually thinking not just of digital synergies, but of digital and human synergies. So take, for instance, brain-computer interface, or, you know, the advancements of cybernetics, or if you're thinking about even wearables and health. There's a fine line between convergence and fusion. Facebook acquired a company about 2 years ago, Control Labs, which is at the early stages of brain-computer interface. And there are a lot of very interesting, they're probably, you know, 20 plus very surprisingly scary companies, scary or not, depending on how you look at life, progressing on brain-computer interface. That is effectively, you can imagine a world where you're not just typing on a computer or not just talking a VR lens or glasses, but actually where you're controlling things through your brain. And so it's that neuroprosthetic motor control, whether it's an implant or an external headset, into humans where you can have that. Now, there's an area in terms of, you know, medical and science, which is very important because it can help, for instance, if you're paralyzed, robotic limbs, and there's a lot of progress which is driven for medical reasons and which is obviously very, very important. Some of it might be more democratized and commercialized and not necessarily without us understanding the full implications of that. And I guess those are the ones to watch very carefully, because ultimately it's literally, as you said, it's fusion, allows you to be hackable, and it allows effectively, you know, it's pretty much a form of transhumanism. And I'm not saying this is good or bad. I'm just saying that this is the direction, and people need to understand, you know, as we talked about earlier, data and understanding the language of that, we need to understand what it means when you're moving just from convergence to actually the fusion of digital and human technologies and the synergies which go with that.
Okay, so, you know, Roger, unfortunately, we're moving to the end. And, you know, last but definitely not least, we couldn't end this without having you telling us about the Disruptive Futures Institute, which you founded. So please tell us about, you know, what's the purpose and why have you created it? And, you know, how can we get more information about it?
Thanks, Maria. Yes. So the starting point is, even before the pandemic, this is a project I've been thinking about for some years, which is effectively emanates from a concern I have as to whether the world grasped the impact of what we've been talking about in our two lovely sessions together. And it's really understanding the convergence, the fusion of these rapidly accelerating technologies and the impact on individuals. And that impacts at the individual level, it impacts work, it impacts society, it impacts governments. It really has an impact across the board. you know, for want of a better term, it is very disruptive. In other words, the way the world sees the opportunities and the way the educational systems are preparing individuals for life is just simply ill-adapted. The short answer is that with the Disruptive Futures Institute, we're trying to democratize some of the concepts we've talked about throughout the world for all ages, for all backgrounds, to just provide, as you are yourselves, a bit more understanding of some of these topics so that people realize what's happening, what the impact could be for them, and what they should do about it, and where to go for more resources. That's basically the objective. We're writing a book, a practical guide on some of these topics. We're developing, you know, content over the next few months and years. 2021 will be an important year for the release of a number of things. And I think the easiest is literally to Google Disruptive Futures Institute, and you'll hopefully find the website. And on the website, you'll find the links to social media, whether it's Instagram, Twitter, YouTube channel, or what have you. Today, there isn't tons of information there, but if people just are interested in these topics, they can certainly feel free to follow, and that will be ramping up over the next few months. And it's, I think, a very important role that a lot of us have, Future Hacker, ourselves, and many, many other people, to hopefully be a catalyst to change.
That's great, Roger. Thank you so much. We're definitely adding the website to the description to make it easier for our listeners. Finally, it's the end. I hope that we can have you back with us. And thank you so much for this lovely conversation.
No, it was so good, Maria. And thank you to you, to the team at Future Hacker for having me. And more importantly, for the work you're doing, because I think we're all very aligned in terms of the getting the message out there and some support on these really critical topics for society today.
Future Hacker. Life. Path. Future.
Apoio Instituto Brasileiro de Ciências e Inovações.